you know, if someone asks me, what is the intent as far as me as the teacher, what is the intent of these Bible studies? And, you know, I guess there's a number of ways I could respond to it, but one of the things that I really feel very strongly about is and really desire is to see us all grow spiritually. And therefore, every day, almost every single day, my prayer is from 1 Corinthians 3:6, where it says, where Paul says, I planted, Apollos watered, but God causes the growth. And so that's my prayer, is that God, that you would cause us to truly grow in our faith. We're going to look at three issues that have the potential to undermine your faith. In Hosea chapter 4, verse 6, God says, my people are destroyed because of a lack of knowledge. And whenever you see that word knowledge in the Bible, you can always substitute the word truth, because they go together. The knowledge of God is true. And we desperately need God's truth because we perish without it. And this is why Jesus warns consistently throughout the four Gospels of false teaching. He says, beware. He usually says, beware. And then he will say something about false teachers. And the reason is he recognizes clearly that believing what is false can be so destructive in our lives. And so I'm going to do this week and next week this short little series on issues that people struggle with, particularly as it relates to having the right knowledge. And these are issues that have been raised and basically challenged the teachings of the Bible. And I've encountered them all. And I would say even in the last year or so, I've counted every single one of them. And so, we need to recognize what we're going to look at this morning is an objection that certain people make as far as a reason in not becoming a Christian. In fact, Tim Keller says, this is the number one reason that modern New Yorkers are turned off by the faith. And I can promise you, you've probably thought about this. And if you haven't, you will again in the future. And I guarantee you people will ask you about it if you get into a conversation about faith. And the issue that I'm talking about, anybody other than Gary Ard want to take a guess? He knows already. He had a mole in here yesterday. It's on the exclusivity of Christianity. Have you ever thought about that much? Have you ever struggled with it? You see, most people think it's an issue of fairness. Because, you know, if I was born in, say, some eastern country like Thailand that is predominantly Buddhist, you know, how could you expect me to be a Christian? Because I didn't have the same exposure that you guys do here in the Bible Belt. And that is a reasonable question for people to ask. And therefore, what's happened, and you've seen this in our culture today, what's happened in our country is that we have become what theologians call religious pluralists. I don't know if you know that term or are familiar with it, but the religious pluralist believes that all religions are different paths that lead to the divine. And therefore, all religions are valid. And people say, you know, that's just kind of good common sense to believe that. Because it's not controversial. Two, it's a way to keep the peace and keep from ruffling other people's feathers. You know, that's kind of what we all want to be respectable today. Now, that's all fine and good. But as a Christian, as you read your Bible, what do you do with all these verses that talk about exclusivity? In fact, let's look up a couple of them. Why don't this side of the room look up John 14, 6. On this side of the room, y'all look up Acts 4, 12. And I'm going to read 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 5. John 14, 6. Everybody probably knows that verse. Vaughn, how about reading that, would you?
All right. Jesus answered, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me.
I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except through me. In Acts 4:12, Perry.
Salvation is found in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given to men by which we must be saved.
Okay. There is salvation in no one else. And then 1 Timothy 2:5 says, and there is one God and one mediator also between God and men, the man Jesus Christ. So here we live in a pluralistic society. Now what are we supposed to do? What are we to think? Particularly based on what the verse, three verses we just read, and there are others. Well, where we want to start is to back up, and this is important. And this will flow into next week, this concept. That is, we need to consider how people perceive reality. You see, there's two realms that we need to consider. One is the subjective realm. When we talk about the subjective realm, we're talking about our feelings, our opinions, our preferences, our tastes. You know, it's like Steve may say, you know, I went to see this movie and it was the best movie I've ever seen. And I go and see it and I think it's horrible. The question, is it a good movie? You see, it's all subjective. It's all a matter of taste. You know, a piece of artwork might be considered to be beautiful, and yet you see no beauty in it. It can be anything. It can be your wife's new dress. It can be your haircut. It can be anything. And something that might be beautiful to you may not be beautiful to me. And that's the subjective realm. But then you have the objective realm. And the objective realm is where things are not subject, or knowledge is not subject to opinion and feelings. It's external. It's outside of our feelings. You see objectivity in mathematics. 2 + 2 = 4. My watch is a Seiko. My wife's name is Holly. This is all objective knowledge. And this is what's so important to know, guys. You can't bring the subjective approach to reality and apply it to what's actually objective. For instance, go back to your days as a student in mathematics, and you take a math test. And the professor puts a big red mark. Wrong. That ever happened to anybody? Ever happened to you? I mean, would you go to the professor and say, the answer I gave is right for me, it may not be right for you. Or you go and say, you know, I feel like I've given you a good answer and that you shouldn't mark it wrong. Now this is important, because when we compare truth claims among the world's religions, what you find the religious pluralist tries to do is bring subjectivity into it. Feelings. Compassion. And that's a problem. It's as if all the religious truth claims are valid because God can be whatever you really want Him to be. An example of this, and this is an old example. This is probably 30, 35 years old. It was in my first book that I wrote back in 92. And it was on the Dick Cavett Show. This is an older group. Everybody knows who Dick Cavett is. There's some younger guys, they never heard of him. But he's kind of like, he'd have a show, it was a little more serious than the Johnny Carson show. But he would have guests on and have an audience. And this particular show, he had Jane Fonda on there. And she comes out and they have a conversation. And then he brings out his second guest and they sit together, is the Archbishop of Canterbury. He was the head of the whole the Anglican Church worldwide. And they get into talking about his work, and Jesus' name comes up, and he says, well, you know, Jesus is the Son of God. And Jane Fonda says, well, he may be the Son of God to you, but he's not the Son of God to me. And the Archbishop said, no, ma'am. Either he is the Son of God, or he's not. There's nothing subjective about that statement. You see, all of the world's religions make certain objective truth claims about the nature of God, about spiritual reality, and most significantly about what happens to you when you die. And either these truth claims are true, or they're not true. And this has nothing to do with your feelings or your taste or your preference. Now I need to tell, let me stop here. Anybody have a comment or question thus far? Well, I need to tell you, I was a religious pluralist in my early years as a Christian. I became a Christian as a sophomore in college. And I mean, Christ did a real work in my life. But as far as all the other religions, I thought, you know, those are all fine. And then something began to change when my senior year, I took a course in comparative religion because I was real curious about it. And what I began to realize as time went by, as I studied these, is that my worldview, my religious pluralist worldview, was not compatible with reality. Now let me share with you what I mean. I'm going to put this up on the board. And then I'm going to ask you a question or two. If you take the four major religions of the world, you've got Hinduism, which believes that there are millions of gods. Not one, not 100, not 1,000. There are millions of gods. And then you have Buddhism, and they don't believe in any God. It's a godless religion. No God. And then you have Islam. One God whose name is Allah. And then you have Christianity, which is the largest religion in the world. And you have a Trinitarian God. And y'all know God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. Now, when I told you earlier that what dawned on me was that my religious view, my pluralistic view, I realize is not compatible with reality. Because the question I had to ask myself is, can all of these be true? Can they? Perry is shaking his head. Can they all be true?
No.
In fact, there's only one thing you can conclude. And what is that?
Three are wrong.
Yeah. Three are wrong. Let me put it another way. These are the two options. Either one of them is true, or what?
None
of them are true. But to say that two of them are true, or three of them are true, or all of them are true, is absurd. It's logically impossible. Years ago, I was on a golf trip with my golf group. And one night after we played, we were having dinner. And the guy that was, I'm not going to mention any names, the guy that was sitting me on my left, this is probably 25 years ago, he said, someone told me, you know a lot about the Bible. And I said, well, I teach Bible studies. That's about it. I hadn't any specialized training. Well, we get into a conversation, and he's a real skeptic, I can tell. And I said to him, all right, well, this is a good starting place to help me kind of figure out where you are. I said, either there is a God or there's not a God. Would you agree with that statement? He said, no, I think they both can be true. I said, you got to be kidding me. I said it again. He said, no, they both can be true. Now, if you know this guy, and some of you probably do, he's a different thinker. He really is. He's out there. The good news is, on my right was another guy who is an accountant. And you know, accountants, do we have any accountants in here? Accountants are very objective. They have to be. In fact, they get in real trouble when they get subjective in their work. But this accountant, and I don't mind telling you who it was, George Jones, who's a pretty wise guy, he said, we'll just assume this man's name is Bob. Bob, I hate to tell you this, but you're wrong. Richard's right. One of those statements is true, and one of those is false. And I share this because this is the way a lot of modern people think. It's kind of what's called the both-and approach to logic. What I was saying is either this or this. But the Eastern way of thinking is both, you know, they can all be true. And that's the way so many people approach religious truth or spiritual claims or whatever you want to call them. Religious truth claims, I guess, is the best word to use. Of course, the real question is, as we look at this up here, and this is because this is what everybody wants to talk about, is who goes to heaven? Don't all paths lead to God when you die? Well, that leads to another problem. As we try to logically think through this, the first two religions, Hinduism and Buddhism, they don't believe in heaven. In fact, they believe in what's called the transmigration of the soul. And you know what that means? What transmigration of the soul literally means? What it is all about?
Reincarnation.
When you die, you don't go to heaven. You are reincarnated. Your soul transmigrates into another being. And it depends. And they have like the eightfold path. They have different, it's basically a standard that you live by. You live a good life and you will move up in the caste system. But if you haven't lived a good life, you move down. You might come back as a dog. You might come back as a rat. And this is what's baffling. You can even come back as an inanimate object, like a shrub or a tree. So they don't believe in heaven. You see, the Hindus hope to reach, it's called moksha, M-O-K-S-H-A, which means you're released from the cycle of rebirth and you become a god. You become one with the cosmic all. The Buddhists, on the other hand, the ultimate goal is to reach nirvana, which means you cease to exist. That's the ultimate goal. You're released from this world full of pain and suffering. So if you say, you know, I believe good Buddhists will go to heaven, they don't believe in heaven. All right, the Muslims, when they die, there is a judgment. And if you've been faithful to Allah, if you've led a good life, you go to paradise. And one of the sure ways you can guarantee it is that if you fight in a holy war and die. The thing about Muslims and their heaven, it's a great place for men. I'm not even sure what happens to women. But you lay around on couches. You have these bashful virgin women wait on you. And you eat and you drink and you just take it easy. It doesn't really sound like a good deal for the virgin women that wait on you. But that's what they believe. And I've read the Quran, and it doesn't really say much about what happens to women. So I just throw that out. Now, Christianity, you die once, and then comes the judgment. So there's no reincarnation. You know, Jesus says, I go and I prepare a place for you. In 1 John chapter 3, verse 2, it says that in the future, that we will see God as He really is. We will be in His presence, and we will be like Him because of that. And then we're given a picture in Revelation 21. In fact, let's turn to that real quick. Revelation 21. You know, the Bible is also very clear about this, and this is something that people don't realize. That we will have resurrected bodies. In other words, one day we could sit around a table like this, all of us, and look at each other. And I can grab Steve and feel his arm. See, most people think we're these spiritual beings. We will have a resurrected body. You see, heaven is a real physical place where there's no evil. There's no hatred. There's no greed. There's no fear. There's no anger. There's no self-centeredness. When you have time, you ought to read sometime Isaiah 25. It talks about this great banquet that we'll experience, where you will literally eat and you will drink. And I don't know what this means, but Psalm 16:11 says, Thou wilt make known to me the path of life. In thy presence is fullness of joy. In thy right hand there are pleasures forever. Anybody have a comment? The point is that in every one of these four religions, when you die, it describes something completely different from one another. What happens to you? And so it's so difficult to logically say all religions are valid. All of them lead to the divine. Now, there's an illustration that the religious pluralists use that's quite famous. It's been used over the years. And the illustration goes like this. There is a wise old king who is trying to teach his people. And it's kind of a parable. And so he brings in to his court this large, huge elephant. And then he brings in behind the elephant four blind men. You ever heard this illustration? Four blind men. And he, one by one, each blind man, he takes them up and they touch a part of the elephant. And the first man touches the trunk. You know, the trunk that goes out and moves and says, this must be some kind of big snake that I'm touching. Up and he puts both hands on the massive side of the elephant and says, it must be some kind of massive wall. The third blind man touches one of the legs, like a big tree trunk. He says, it must be a tree. And the final guy touches the tail and says this must be some kind of rope, a cord. And in the parable, each of the blind men represent the world's religions. They all come to different conclusions about the spiritual world, but each contain a portion of the truth. The problem is they just can't see the total picture. And what he says is, you know, if you were like the king and could see the entire picture, all the world religions would give up their exclusive beliefs. And you would conclude, we're all, so to speak, we're all feeling the same elephant. But there's a major flaw in this, in this parable. You know what the flaw is? You want to take a guess? Can you see the flaw? Well, in the parable, the elephant represents the vast spiritual world that's out there. And the four blind men represent the four major religions of the world. But this is the question. In the parable, who is the king? Who is the one who sees all? Who is the one that can explain all? You see, the modern religious pluralist says, I am the king. I see the entire picture. You Christians don't. You Muslims don't. You Buddhists and y'all don't see the whole picture. But I, the religious pluralist, I see. My knowledge of the spiritual world is superior to all others. Do you see what I'm saying? For you to say that every religion of the world is valid and that every religion sees part of the truth assumes that you see the whole truth. And that you have a superior knowledge and understanding over everybody else. In one sense, it's a real arrogance to say, I know all there is to know about spiritual reality, and that all religions lead to the same place. Does that make sense? I want to make two final points. And one of them is I think, probably is the heart of this whole question, which we'll come back to in just a second. Let me make this first point. You know, I think as we consider this, everybody needs to stop and consider who or what is the spiritual authority that stands behind your faith. See, for the religious pluralist, it's more a matter of feelings and instinct. Pascal says that's the problem with too many people. He says they invariably arrive at their beliefs not on the basis of proof or what is true, but on the basis of what they find attractive subjectively. But you know, you think about it, you don't do this when you're seeking, you've got a medical problem and you need some help. What do you do? You go to one who has authority in the field of medicine where you have a problem. It's like years ago, I was in the Newark, New Jersey airport. I was trying to get to a wedding, and I was stuck in that airport. It was snowing. And so I had a lot of time on my hands. And I remember walking down one of the corridors, and there's this young, starry-eyed girl. She was probably 18, 19 years old. She was handing flowers out and looking for donations. And you could just tell that she was in some kind of cult. So I stopped. Like I said, I had time. I stopped, and I had a conversation with her. And I said, now tell me what you're doing. Why are you doing this? What is it that you believe? Well, she basically had this Eastern religious view of life. And we got into conversation. It's been so long. I mean, this has been, it was back in like the late 70s. I was probably 24, 25. And so the conversation is a little fuzzy. But I remember finally asking her, asked her this question. Well, who is the authority behind what you believe? Why do you believe this? I mean, there has to be some kind of authority, authoritative figure, where you get these, I didn't say weird beliefs, but these beliefs. And I'll never forget, she has a backpack, and she reaches down and whips out this picture of this guru that lives over in India. And I asked her, I said, why do you follow him? Why do you put your faith in him? And I'll never forget what she said. Because he is enlightened. He is enlightened. And that ended the conversation. I think this is a huge issue. All people need to ask this question. Who in this life has the spiritual authority to point us to what is true? And clearly, guys, and I realize I'm a Christian when I say this, but clearly Jesus stands head and shoulders above everyone else. In fact, I've got a CD called The Uniqueness of Christ in a World Full of Religions that basically compares him with all the other religious figures of the major religions. Now I want to read you some words from David Platt. Y'all know who David Platt is? He was the head of Church of Brook Hills, and now he's moved somewhere. He's got another ministry he's doing. But he shares this story. He says, I remember sitting outside a Buddhist temple in Indonesia. Men and women fill the elaborate, colorful temple grounds where they daily perform their religious rituals. Meanwhile, I was engaged in a conversation with a Buddhist leader and a Muslim leader in this particular community. They were discussing how all religions are fundamentally the same and only superficially different. We may have different views about small issues, one of them said, but when it comes down to the essential issues, each of religions are all the same. Platt says, I listened for a while and then they asked me what I thought. I said, it sounds as though you both picture God, or whatever you might call God, at the top of this mountain. And it seems as if you believe that we are all at the bottom of the mountain, and I may take one route up the mountain, you may take another route, and in the end, we're going to all end up in the same place. They smiled as I spoke, and they all replied, sure, that's exactly right. You get it. Platt says, then I leaned in and said, well, let me ask you a question. What would you think if I told you that the God at the top of the mountain actually came down to where we are? What would you think if I told you that God doesn't wait for people to find their way to him, but instead, he comes to us? They thought for a moment and then responded, that'd be great. I replied, well, let me introduce you to Jesus. He says, this is the gospel. As long as you and I understand salvation as checking off a box to get to God, we will find ourselves in the meaningless sea of world religions that actually condemn the human race by exalting our supposed ability to get to God. On the other hand, when you and I realize that we are morally evil, that we are dead in our sins, and that we deserve God's wrath with no way out on our own, we begin to discover our desperate need for Christ. Finally, I want to take just a minute and get to really kind of the heart, I think, of this issue. And that is kind of where we started. And I think it's the real reason that the religious pluralist believes what he believes. And that gets back to the issue of fairness. Now, is it really fair where we've been raised here in the Bible Belt and we've been exposed to Christianity and someone in another part of the world has never even heard of it or knows very little of it? Well, I do want to, and I don't, we're going to run out of time here, but I do want to have everybody turn to Acts chapter 14. This kind of explains in one simple sentence what's happened in the 5,000 years of human history. Acts 14, 16. Gary Art, how about reading that for us? Acts 14, 16.
And in the generations gone by, he permitted all the nations to go their own ways.
He permits all the nations to go their own ways. You know, you see this throughout the Old Testament. You see people go their separate ways. They become pagans. They form pagan religions. And this explains why there are thousands of religions in the world today. I could start one tomorrow if I wanted to. But I know this can still be troubling and can potentially undermine your faith. And I want to close with some very enlightening words from Tim Keller. So if you would, turn to John 21. Do you realize what Jesus is saying? He's talking, you know, do you know how Peter, you know, Peter was executed. Do you know how he was executed? He was crucified upside down. And Jesus is telling him, you know, this is what's coming. This is what you can expect. And what does Peter do? He says, well, what about John? What's going to happen to him? And Jesus says, Peter, stop worrying about what happens to everybody else. What does that have to do with you? He says, I have a plan for John, and you don't know it, and you never will. I never tell you other people's stories. You will need to focus on your own. He said, Peter, you don't understand what is fair and unfair. You don't understand what is just and unjust. In fact, in Proverbs, we're told that as sinful people, we don't understand what real justice is. He says, Peter, you don't know the secrets of people's hearts or the details of their lives. Quit worrying about others, and you, Peter, follow me. 25 years ago or so, I was going through the investigative study with a guy, and we were meeting at lunch. And, you know, we would talk about it, and I wasn't making any progress with him. And then he shot me one day. He said, I got to quit worrying about the Bushman in Africa. Because this is the one thing that I do know. I need Jesus in my life. And has never looked back. A very dynamic believer today. Kind of what he was basically referring to in these verses. I can't worry about this. I've got to follow him. That's why Philip Yancey puts it this way. He says, I've learned about magnifying glasses when I'll use my dictionary. He says, when I train the glass on a word, the tiny print shows up crisp and clear in the center or focal point, while around the edges it grows progressively distorted. In an exact parallel, Jesus has become the focal point of my faith, and increasingly I am learning to keep the magnifying glass of my faith focused on Jesus. In my spiritual journey as well as in my writing career, I have long lingered in the margins, pondering all types of difficult questions, like the ones that we've considered today. And he says, over time, when I do that, my faith and everything else kind of becomes fuzzy. He says, but when I focus my eyes on Christ, the authority who stands behind all that I believe, he says, clarity and coherence return to my life.